back. It feels like I've been talking to myself again. But it's the only way you're ever gonna learn. You look back and it's all in the past. I'm dwelling on the thoughts I cannot say to you. If I don't say the words, then maybe it's not true.
Hi, welcome along to Steve Raitt's True Crime Podcast, and delighted to see you. I'm joined by Janice McAfee. How are you, Janice?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, great. Great to have you on the show, and a fascinating story over the next hour, I'm sure that you're going to share. And really what we're here to talk about is a tragedy. I would describe it as over the last couple of years for you yourself. And your late husband, John McAfee, and that name, your surname, I guess, for a lot of people who will have tuned in today, thinking that surname rings a bell. It looks, why do I know that name? And it's of course because, John set up a company and wrote the very first commercial antivirus software, McAfee. Yes. And that's, he set up McAfee Associates to sell his creation. Very, very successful in his chosen line of work. How did you meet John?
So I met John the night after he was deported from Guatemala, after the whole saga that he went through in Belize. And I met him on South Beach in Florida. I was working as a prostitute at the time. And I happened to see him. So what happened was my car was parked across from his hotel that he was staying at the Beacon Hotel in South Beach. And I was going to be leaving South Beach to go to, there's a casino that I was going to go to just because there was nothing happening where I was. And so me and my girlfriend were walking, and I happened to see John standing outside of Johnny Rockets. And he was talking to one of the employees. And as I passed by him, our eyes met, and I smiled and nodded, and he returned the gesture. But I just kept walking because he didn't look interested. And, I wasn't interested in trying to make him become interested. So I just kept walking. And for whatever reason, I turned back and I saw him looking at my butt. So I was like, but I just kept walking still because I had already made up my mind that I was, going to leave. And when I got to his hotel, the night security came outside. And he's someone that I had spoken to before, because oftentimes when you're working, you obviously get familiar with the security of the hotels or whoever's at the front desk, because they're able to tell you who's in town, what parties are in town, if the cops are out harassing girls. So, I was speaking to him and asking him these sorts of questions, what's going on and who's in town. And he happened to look down the street and he saw John was standing there. And he told me, he said, well, you know who that is, right? And I was like, I have no idea. No. And he said, well, that's John McAfee. And I said, who is that? And he said, the McAfee antivirus. Well, that's the creator. And so I was like, okay. But I kind of hesitated a little bit. I wasn't sure if I wanted to go, but I said, screw it. I'll just go and see what happens. So he had moved on by that time, so I didn't see him anymore. So we kind of ran down the street and caught up to him at the News Cafe, which is not all of these, like his hotel, the Johnny Rockets, the News Cafe. It was within walking distance, within 5 minutes of each other. So he hadn't got very far. And when I saw him in front of the News Cafe, he was smoking a cigarette, talking to the workers there, the waiters there. And I asked him for a cigarette. And while he was lighting my cigarette, he asked me, what are you girls out here doing? Are you drugging and rolling old men? To which I said, we don't use drugs. And from my reply, it intrigued him. And so he invited us to sit down and have coffee with him because he said that's, what he was getting ready to do. And, we sat down, ordered our coffee, and I immediately went into my spiel. Are you looking for some entertainment? You can have two for one or whatever, just to get it out of the way. But like I said, I had already assessed that he wasn't interested, and that was true because he turned that down. And so I then asked him, well, what brings you to town? Are you here on business or pleasure? And he was kind of surprised at that questioning because, unbeknownst to me, he had been top of the news for months, and especially since he had gotten deported from Guatemala to Miami. It was surprising to him that I wouldn't have known who he was, but I genuinely didn't know who he was. I didn't watch the news, so I had no idea. And so I said, no, I don't know who you are. What's your story? What brings you to Miami? And so over the course of maybe 2 or 3 hours, we just talked, and it was just him talking about what happened with him in Belize, and me asking some questions here and there, and him obliging me with answers. And it was a really nice conversation. But while he was sitting there, was he so he had his back to the cafe, and he was kind of watching the street. He was watching the cars as they were driving by, watching the people as they were driving by, intently watching them. And so I immediately recognized that, because that's something that I obviously would have to do in my line of work. You have to be aware of your surroundings, and because it's very dangerous, the line of work. And so it just resonated with me that probably what he was saying was true. Obviously I didn't know, but from what he was telling me, it just seemed that that was, the case, that he was obviously still felt that he was in some danger. And so after that, my girlfriend, she was high on Molly, so she wasn't really adding much to the conversation. And John asked me to get rid of her, which I did. I asked her, I told her he just wants to hang out with me or something like that. And so she left, and we talked a little more, and then he invited me back to his hotel. And when we did that, he asked me if we could just cuddle, which, I'd never asked her, no one had ever asked me that before. So immediately I was thinking that it was something sexual. So I was like, sure. I had no idea what it was. I was like, sure, I'm sure I could do it. So yeah, we could cuddle. But he genuinely just wanted to cuddle. And that's what we did. He wrapped himself all around me, and he laid his head on my shoulder. And within 5 minutes, he was asleep, snoring, peacefully sleeping. And it was just beautiful, a beautiful night, that we obviously, my life was kind of rough. I had a pimp who was extremely abusive, so he got beat re regularly. And so for me, it was just a nice night, to have someone, to be able to rest in my arms that way. It was just nice. And that's how we met.
Yeah, I mean, it's it's an incredible story and an incredible journey, as we'll discover as well, has a tragic end. But you mentioned the situation that that he'd had in Belize. Can you just expand on that a little bit?
Yes. So what happened was, so I think everyone knows, or that it's been widely reported about his neighbor being murdered. But there was a whole series of events that led up that happened to him before that. And so it was April, I believe, Aprilish of 2012. I'm somewhere around that time. John said that, this is as he told me, so I'm sharing it to you as he told me. So he said that there were two representatives from the government that came to his property where his lab was, and his lab was not a meth lab, which was, I don't know how that became news or reported about, but he was working on a topical antivirus. So he was moving obviously from computers to people, because living in that jungle climate, he had, when he came back to America, he had a lot of bite marks, all over his legs and his arms. And so his topical antivirus was going to address that, to help, kind of something kind of like a along the lines of mosquito repellent, if you will. But it healed up these bite marks, and he was already actually had developed some of it, and the locals were using it, and it worked. So anyways, these two representatives from the government came to his property in Belize and asked him if he would be willing to give a donation of $2 million to some local campaign of it. He didn't never said who, but anyways, just to donate this $2 million, and they would give him favors, around the island, whether it was property or women or tax breaks, whatever, for that donation. And he said, no, thank you, and asked them, you know, and they left. Eddie said a week after that, his property was then raided by the gang suppression unit, which is the GSU. And when they came, they destroyed $500,000 of his lab and his lab. So his lab was completely destroyed. They brought all the employees, John included, and they had them handcuffed on their knees in the sun, you know, for like 14 hours, I believe he said it was. They shot one of his dogs in front of him, and they arrested him, and they said because of a gun that he had that wasn't licensed, but then he was able to have someone produce the license, so they dropped that charge and let him go. And then it was shortly after that, maybe a week or so later after that, the same representatives came back and asked him if he had changed his mind about the donation, to which he said, you know, no, screw you, get off my property. So this immediately for him sent him on a mission, if you will, to try to prove that he was set up for this raid on his property, because he wanted an apology from, he wanted an apology, as silly as that sounded. He always felt that it was probably silly looking back on it, you know, wanting an apology for that. But anyways, that's what he wanted because he felt violated, you know, obviously. And so this is what he was seeking to prove. And what happened was he ended up giving computers to laptops to some of the secretaries that work for individuals that were high up in the government. And on those computers was keystroke logging information. And so he was obviously able to get into their systems that way. And he said, instead of finding proof of them setting him up for the raid, he actually found proof of drug trafficking, human trafficking, money laundering, murder for hire, you know, you name it, a whole gamut of criminal activity that was, you know, that obviously higher up officials within the government were involved in. And obviously, when you understand the Caribbean and you understand that a lot of people do launder their money through there, you can imagine what type of people he would have found in that information, you know, politicians, very wealthy people, you know, around the world, you name it, because that's just a hub for that kind of activity. And so, so when he found out that information, he had, I think people, women maybe that he was able to pay them, he hired them to kind of parse through the information to find information relevant to him. And so one of the young ladies was sleeping with someone within the GSU, I believe. I'm not exactly sure, but she was sleeping with someone within the police department. And they were just kind of pillow talking, you know, and she mentioned that what she was doing for John, you know, this information that she had collected. So that information was now public. And that immediately began his kind of having to go on the run within Belize because of that situation, because now they wanted that information. And so John had other properties on San Pedro Island in which he would go and try to hide out at. And so he was being hunted, if you will, in Belize before all of this happened. And then when his neighbor was murdered, he was convinced that it was actually a botched hit on him.
So but this was Gregory. This was Gregory Fall, wasn't it?
Gregory Fall. Yes, correct. And he felt that they just, you know, went to the wrong house. They got the wrong house, the wrong American's house, because obviously they were both wealthy Americans. And they did live next to each other, but it wasn't like their homes were exactly next to each other. You know, it's on a beach and there was a few miles between their homes. But so that's what he always felt happened, that it was a botched hit. And so once that happened, that's why if anybody's familiar with reports from that time, you'll hear John speaking about, you know, what he thought was happening to him, that the government was coming after him, and that he didn't have anything to do with his neighbor's murder. And so that's the Belize situation.
Yeah. I mean, that situation of the death of the neighbor really set, you know, set his life really into a spiral. I couldn't imagine being in that kind of situation where, you know, you feel paranoid, really, you know, that the government are trying to get you.
Yeah, I'm sure it was very intense. You know, he told me stories of nights when you know, when they would be like surrounding his condo, or you know, I think he said that there was a shootout at some point. And so it was obviously very extremely intense. And from there, what happened was he was able to somehow get out of Belize and get to Guatemala. And then I think it's been widely reported about how he was outed of being in Guatemala by the Vice reporters who had traveled with him, and they had taken a picture of him that said, "We're with McAfee suckers," and they forgot to scrape the EXIF data, and so that's how everybody found out that he was in Guatemala. So he was able to then hire a very powerful attorney in Guatemala, and they legally figured out a way to kind of stay the extradition that Belize was demanding him to be extradited back to Belize. And that's also where you see the reports of him faking a heart attack, which he did. You know, obviously they didn't know it was fake at the time, but it was faked because his attorney, I guess, had said he needed some time to get the necessary documentation before the judge to sign it in order to stay the extradition. And so that's why he faked the heart attack. And then him being subsequently then deported from Guatemala to Miami. Why Miami? I don't know, but I'm glad it happened that way.
I mean, the one thing that used to stand out for me about John was the fact that he was a libertarian. He advocated decriminalization of cannabis, an end to the war on drugs, something which a lot of people across the world support. And he also ran a presidential campaign in 2016, didn't he?
Yes, he did. That was such an awesome time in our relationship. It
There we
was,
go. That brings back memories there, I guess.
yeah, it has good memories. It was fun, because he ran his campaign the way he wanted to, you know, which is not anything like anyone else would have done. His campaign videos that he created were amazing. I'll have to start sharing those, but they were just not even what you would expect from a campaign video, you know, where people kind of attacking another candidate, or saying, "I'm going to do this if I'm elected president," or whatever. And, you know, he never said that. You know, he just gave more of a real, you know, this is life, this is the world, this is how things are, and this is how I see it. And if you want to change to happen, you have to be the change, and you have to be willing to step outside of your known ideologies, and be willing to, I guess, be willing to just be open, you know, to diff being different, doing differently. I guess I can make this comparison. You know, in America, everyone complains about politics and the politicians, but when it comes time to vote, we go out and vote for the same people. So it's like, if you're expecting change to happen, you can't keep continuing to vote for the same people, because that's insanity. That's literally the definition of insanity, doing the same thing, expecting different results. So, you know, he always was one to even advocate for electing a homeless person, because that would be better than what we currently have, you know, and just vote everybody out instead of voting for those same, you know, top names that are in there, because that's how they're getting in there, where there's people voting for them. But if we stopped voting for them and maybe just voted at random just to see what would happen, you know, I'm sure things maybe could have an opportunity to turn around. It's not a definite solution, but it's better than what is happening.
Yeah, I mean, to run not one but two presidential campaigns is quite
Yeah.
something. I mean, running as a libertarian as well, was his campaign about cryptocurrency in 2020?
It was, yeah. He spoke a lot about that. Just because, obviously, given our situation, you know, at that time we were sort of in hiding, on the run, and obviously crypto was a way for us to be able to move maneuver and undetected, you know, privately, you know, in a private way. And so he obviously advocated for more so not just crypto as a whole, but decentralizing exchanges, decentralized crypto as well, privacy coins, because he felt that if the exchanges were centralized, then someone could come and shut it down. You know, because they know where their servers are, they know where the offices are, so they could come and be shut down, you know, at random. And so that's kind of what he, you know, campaigned on with related to the crypto.
Yeah. So getting back to your relationship after that, that first meeting, that first night, we talked about, you and wanting to cuddle and falling asleep. How did things progress for you? Because, you've already mentioned, what your profession was, a very dangerous profession as well. We're hasten to add, how do you go that next step? Because, I'm a man. I'm in a relationship. I've been married 20 years. I've never,
Congratulations.
thank you. I've never used, that kind of profession for myself. But I know a lot of men do. And from my perspective, I can never imagine that you would progress. I mean, I guess we've all seen the film Pretty Woman, so we know it happens. But how did it progress for you guys?
So that thing like Pretty Woman, obviously. And I will say, you know, most men are just looking for an itch to be scratched, if you will, right? And it's nothing more than that. And so I guess it was maybe that wasn't necessarily the thing with John, although sex was not super important. I mean, obviously, you know, there was some, but it wasn't the mainstay. You know, I think he, because of the situation with Belize, because of my profession, and because of my knowledge of the streets and knowing how to maneuver and stay safe, I think it was necessary for him. Anyways, he felt, I'm assuming, would have felt that he needed someone who could have his back as well. So it's not just him looking out for himself, because obviously two pairs of eyes is better than one. And so I think that was initially why he wanted to continue our relationship. And so he stayed in Miami maybe a week, maybe two. It wasn't very long, but I was with him every day. Yeah, so that's how that progressed. And then he ended up leaving, and he went, he said he was going to buy a truck, and he would, you know, contact me in a week or so and let me know where to come and meet him. And so you know, during that week I was like, you know, oh, he's not gonna call me, whatever, you know, that was a nice time and whatever. And you know, in the meantime, you know, I had obviously Googled him, and that's when I saw our pictures. Someone had taken pictures of us. We had been walking along Lincoln Drive. We were going to lunch, and someone had taken our pictures. So this is my first time seeing my picture, you know, sort of in a news, you know, paper, online, anyways. But you know, my pimp always was trying to figure out a way to get money from him. You know, if he could extort him or take pictures of him and sell it to the tabloids, because at this time no one knew where he was. You know, after he had done, I think he had done a couple of interviews in Miami, and after he'd done that, no one knew where he was. They didn't know where he was staying, who he was with, what was happening. And so the pimp was thinking we could get some money from tabloids if I did that. And you know, I wasn't interested in that. For me, I understood what my meeting him meant. You know, it meant that I may have an opportunity here to escape this life. I didn't want to be a prostitute anymore. You know, I just turned 30. 25 was the max age I was giving it, you know, but things happened, whatever. But I was just fed up with, you know, that life. And so I didn't want to do anything to jeopardize that. I didn't want to do anything to jeopardize John wanting to keep me around. So I, you know, I didn't do the things that the pimp was suggesting. And so then I eventually went and met with him in Tennessee. I flew to him to Tennessee, and we drove on a 3 week, it was a 3 week trip from Tennessee to Portland, Oregon. I don't know why it was Portland, Oregon, but we very, you know, lazily and slowly drove across the country. He later explained to me he was we were stopping at these places because he had money somewhere hidden in these places. And that's what he was doing, collecting wherever he had the money, he was collecting that. And so, but I had no idea that that's what was happening. And it was a really nice trip. You know, people, I think I've heard people say that, you know, the way to test a relationship is if you can go on a road trip together and not want to kill each other. And we didn't want to kill. I really enjoyed that time. It was a really good time. We listened to books on tape. I can't remember the book, or books on CD. I don't remember the books, but it was awesome.
It wasn't one of my books.
no, I'm sorry. But it was awesome, though. I never listened to books on CD. So, you know, when you get wrapped up in the story and we're driving, and but something I will say, which made me very nervous, is that when he drove, if he got a message or something, he would get busy in his phone. He was just one of those guys. I think a friend of his would call him the absent-minded professor, because you just get involved in something and everything else is just, you know, out of mind. So he'd be driving with his knee on the steering wheel, and he's like in his phone, you know, texting or emailing. And I was like, you know, can you watch the road, please? But he was an excellent driver, and obviously I didn't have anything to worry about. But just talking about this obviously brings up certain memories. So,
of course it will. Yeah. And you know, as I say, feel free, you know, to say whatever you want and to hold back. As I said before we came on air, you know, I am very, you know, conscious of the circumstances that you find yourself in, and it can be difficult to talk about. I've got to be honest, the photographs that I looked at whilst I was doing my research before we started the interview, I've got to be honest, Janice, you look so happy.
I was so happy, so very incredibly happy. Obviously, there's a lot of other things that were happening, just because of the situation and John being who he was. But I was genuinely happy with him, and no matter what else was happening, I wanted to be with him. I was happy with him, and I wanted to be with him as long as he wanted me with him. You know, it wasn't a situation where, you know, I would have, you know, went crazy on him if he wanted to, you know, not be with me anymore. I would have accepted that. But that wasn't, you know, that wasn't really the case. And I don't know. He's just a very likable person, you know. And also I felt that he needed someone to be looking out for him as well. Not that he couldn't handle himself, because obviously he was very capable of doing that. He did not need me at all. But I just wanted to help him in that way, because I was, you know, kind of savvy in this, and, you know, because of my background being in dangerous situations, I knew how to handle myself. I knew how to maneuver. So I was able to meet him where he was in that, you know, although the people that were after him were obviously a higher caliber than what I was used to dealing with. But the things that I had learned definitely helped me to be an asset in that regard to him.
With a relationship and, you know, moving on as time goes on, did he ever open up to you about his past? You know, we've spoken about the death of his neighbor. I mean, clearly, you know, he said that he felt that that was somebody else. Did he ever speak to you about that and, you know, give you any reason why he felt that potentially it was supposed to be him rather than, did he go into that, or who may have done it? Was he 100% sure that it was the government?
That was his conviction was, that it was 100% someone working, obviously not the government officials, obviously, but them hiring out this, you know, this job or whatever. But he was thoroughly convinced of that. And because of, as I explained, the information that he had collected and them finding out that he had collected said information. So, obviously it would be very important for that to not get out and not go be publicly made available, you know? So, and it was obviously whatever the information was obviously important enough for them to continue to kind of come after him, even after he was in America. And that's kind of where things, as I said, you know, there were other things happening in our relationship in the background. And that's what I'm referring to, because there was, is it okay if I go into the story?
Let's do it. Yeah.
Okay, so John and I, so we settled in Portland in January of 2013. And from January 2013 till about April-ish, I was not in communication with my family. No talking, no none of that, because I had fully signed on to the idea of being with John. And so we got into this huge fight one day, and he kicked me out, and I didn't have any money. And he didn't let me keep my car. So, but I was able to leave with my clothes and my dog. And so I'm trying to figure out how to, what am I going to do? Like I didn't have family that I could call and ask for help. That just wasn't an option. And I didn't know anyone in Portland to that I could call and ask for assistance. So, like a dummy, I decided the best thing to do was to call the pimp. But I wasn't calling him because I wasn't wanted to get back with him. That wasn't the intention of my calling him. I was just wanting him to send me money. And obviously obviously didn't think that through, what that would mean, me reaching back out to him. And so instead of him sending me money, he sent me a client, a gentleman caller, if you will. And so we did our business. He paid me. And then after that, he told me, he said, "Well, I know you know John McAfee. And so, we're going to be having a meeting and you're going to come. Your pimp already knows everything. And so we just want you to do some things for us, give us some information about John." He was like, "But it'll be explained at this meeting." And I was like, "Well, I don't know John, so I don't know what you're talking about." And, we kind of went back and forth like that. And so then a few days later, the meeting came, and it's the same person who then explained that he was a cartel representative. He was with the Sinaloa cartel. And what they wanted me to do was provide them information about John. It was later that they added other things that they wanted me to do. But I think at that time, they just were saying that they just wanted information because I was very vocal about my unwillingness to do what they were asking me to do. And to the point that I was threatened, if I didn't cooperate. And so now we have this situation. Now, I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure that John found out about this meeting, obviously, because he then called me and he wanted to reconcile, right? And so I thought about telling him, but I didn't trust him, because of this fight that we had, and he kicked me out. And so, mind you, it wasn't just about him. Obviously, I had baggage that I was carrying from the situation with my pimp and all of that. So I will say that a lot of that fed into why I didn't want to trust him, and why I was so why this wall, was immediately put up because of that situation. And so anyways, we reconciled. I moved back to the apartment, and then began this series of things that my pimp was calling me and meeting me and asking me to do. They wanted me to make a spare key for our apartment. They wanted me to, because I wouldn't make the spare key for the apartment, they then wanted me to leave the door open because you had, in order to get into our building, you needed to have a sort of key lock in order to get in. And so, I didn't do that. They asked me to park the car on the street in a certain area so that they could have access to it to disable it in some way. And so all of these things that they were doing, I was, telling John specifically about the car. I told him, instead of parking on the street, park it in the parking garage where it's safer. And and don't go out by yourself, at nighttime, or just period, if I'm not here, because I was going back at that time to California to visit my children. So I would tell him, if I'm not here, don't go out by yourself, have someone drive you around, and trying to kind of safeguard him, or at least help him to protect himself from the things that I knew that they were trying to do, to collect him. And this all culminated or went to a climax when I was given a substance. It was a grainy gray substance in a little baggie, and they asked me to put it in his food when I cooked for him. And so obviously I didn't do that. And I think the things that I didn't do helped maybe helped John to understand where kind of I stood with that, that I wasn't trying to do him harm, even though I wasn't speaking to him about what happened. I just wasn't comfortable doing that. But I think he could see from my actions that I wasn't trying to hurt him. And I think that's maybe why he kept me around. Also, obviously, because he needed to have the information to know what was happening around him, what was, what plans were being made. So, yeah, it was a very intense time, very intense situation. And that went on for quite some time because we moved around a lot. And so I was able to go months without having to speak to my pimp because there were a lot of situations that happened that we had to move and get safe and get settled again. So so that whole situation with the pimp and me being threatened, that went on for a few years, the first couple of years in our relationship.
In October 2020, John was arrested in Spain, wasn't he, over US tax evasion charges? Tell me about that.
So we were let me just say this first. We were traveling, while we were in Europe, we were traveling a lot. And John, we had before his arrest, we had just flown to Germany, or tried to anyways, from the Barcelona airport. So he had given his passport, the same passport that he gave when he got arrested. So there was no issues, no flagging, nobody stopped him and asked him any questions. We were, ushered right through security, no problems at all. And when we got to Germany, we obviously were had to be turned back because of COVID restrictions being enacted again. And so we had to go back to the Barcelona airport. So fast forward to October 2020, John was again flying out of the same Barcelona airport using the same passport that he had used, maybe a month or so earlier. And he said, he explained to me that his passport had been flagged as stolen, and that's why they detained him initially. And once they had him in custody, it was then the next day that this warrant became public or was put into the system. And so now he was being held for tax evasion or tax related crimes, and being held for extradition to the US for those crimes, alleged crimes.
And obviously, that was the beginning of, probably the worst time in your life, I guess, because the US federal prosecutors brought criminal and civil charges. They alleged, obviously, that John had failed to file his income taxes over a 4-year period. It just became an impossible situation for him, didn't it?
It did, but I will say this. So once John came back to when he was deported, when he was came back from Guatemala to America, he never paid taxes again. And he made that publicly known. He spoke about it. He even campaigned about that during his 2016 election. So this was public knowledge. And if they wanted him for this, if there was a problem, they could have found him anywhere at any time. They could have garnered his he was getting Social Security. They could have garnered their taxes from that, as they do. They could have come in and repossessed his properties. All of these things could have happened, or even sent a letter and said, "This is the problem, that we have an issue." But none of that ever happened. He even would send letters to the IRS yearly and say, "I'm not filing my taxes," and he'd give them reason why. So this was not something that he just was secretly not doing. He was very public and vocal about his unwillingness to pay taxes and why, because he felt that they were unconstitutional. Income taxes, anyway, were unconstitutional, and he didn't want to pay them because over the years, he said he had paid over $50 million in taxes, and he obviously didn't feel that he was getting any services from the government in which his taxes were going toward. And especially when he had these issues internationally, and he would try to go to the embassies, and they wouldn't help him. They would refuse to help him. So definitely would put a sour taste in anyone's mouth, about taxes. And again, income taxes in America, at least anyways, they are unconstitutional. And so that's why he was just so adamant on that being the hill that he was willing to die on, if you will.
Yeah, and he was imprisoned for this.
Yes, he was in prison for this. And
What was his
so
conditions like, Janice?
in the prison, I
I
don't.
mean, I've got this photograph. I'd never seen this before until I started looking out. Is that the actual prison, or is that in a different situation?
I can't see the picture just yet.
Okay, there's a photograph of him in it
Oh, okay.
on a double
This,
bunk.
yes. So this happened. This was in the Dominican Republic. This was not in
Okay.
Spain.
Okay.
This was a different time.
So what were his conditions like?
From what he expressed to me, he said the people there were kind to him. The other inmates were, the guards were. He said initially some of the guards from different parts of the prison would come over just to meet him and talk to him. A lot of the prisoners were surprised that he was in there with them, because he was in like what we call in America general population. So he was not secluded in a private area. He was with the general population of the prison. So, murderers, rapists, drug traffickers, human traffickers, whoever was in there, he was with them. They would call him Papa America, and he obviously knew how to handle himself. It wasn't his first time being in a foreign prison, so he definitely knew how to handle himself. I don't think he ever had any issues, at least not that he told me about. Well, he told me about one where someone tried to kind of get in his face a little bit, but one of the other prisoners came and got in between that and said, "Hey, we don't do that." So they were very protective of him and just looking out for him. Now I'm only saying what he told me. It could have been pretty rough for him, as I would imagine it might have been, but I would imagine he probably just didn't want me to worry, so he probably maybe not tell me everything that was occurring. But for the most part, what he shared with me was that he was okay, and he was handling it as best he could, as best as anyone could, in that situation.
Was he entitled to visits?
He was entitled to visits, but he did not want me to visit him because there was a concern for security that maybe someone might follow me, leaving to where we were staying, which, obviously we were trying to keep that private. And so I didn't visit him, although I wanted to, but he obviously had visits with his Spanish attorney. And but we spoke every day. We were able to speak three times a day. That's how many phone calls he was able to have. And the phone calls were 8 minutes a piece. So, we spoke every day. And we had lawyers working on the situation. So he understood, there was a plan. He understood that what was, the process of things that were happening. He had two Spanish attorneys, because there was another that we had found who was more knowledgeable on extraditions. He had obviously two American attorneys, because aside from the tax charges, the SEC brought on some other charges. And I think for me, it just seemed like it was a way to make sure that there was no way for him to escape this, that they could actually get him extradited, because the tax charges are not that serious. Honestly, he would have just gotten a slap on the wrist if it was something where it happened in America. If they brought these charges, it would just be a slap on the wrist and a fine. No jail time, nothing serious like that. And one other thing was that they never mentioned what he owed in taxes. So they never said, "This is what you owe us." They just said, "You've not paid taxes." And he actually never filed taxes. I think I might have said this, but he'd never filed taxes during that time. And so for there to be fraud, which is also something that they were claiming, you would have to be filing taxes and not being truthful on him. And so obviously, yeah, we're just looking for anything, I think, to be able to get him back to America. And so moving forward, I guess, to the day of the day of his death, I guess we should move forward to that. Or maybe I'll let you ask another question.
Well, yeah, no, but you preempted where we're going to go, and again, take your time, going through this, because this is still going to be quite raw for you. But I do just want to mention the day before John's death that you did post. I read in one of the British newspaper reports, put a tweet out, Now the US authorities are determined to have John die in prison to make an example of him for speaking out against the corruption within their government agencies. There is no hope of him ever having a fair trial in America. And, you know, that must be a tweet that really, I wouldn't say haunts you, but, you know, it's very prophetic, Janice.
I know.
Just take your time.
Yeah. Obviously, I didn't, you know, obviously I wasn't wanting that to happen, but it just seemed that that was the case, you know, because they were trying so desperately to tack on, you know, all of these charges. It was more so the SEC case that was problematic, you know, that they were basically their case was based solely on his tweet, you know, which it's a public forum, you know, people say things sometimes and, you know, how could that then be used to criminally prosecute someone? And so I think it was just a frustration of, you know, knowing everything that we had lived through, you know, all of the attacks that happened, you know, there was nonstop things that were happening to try to collect him or do harm to him, you know, there. And I was not a unique person that was tasked to try to, you know, help people collect him. There was sort of a revolving door of people that came in and out of our lives that were, you know, either coming to make money off of him or do him actual harm. So it was something that he had to deal with nonstop from the time he got back to America. And, you know, looking back on the tweet, yeah, it is pretty prophetic. So that happened. And, you know, we had discussed, John and I had discussed, you know, in detail what was going to happen when he went to court for the hearing for the extradition. And we all knew that they were going to grant the extradition. This was not a surprise to anybody, not a surprise to me, to John, to any of his attorneys. We all knew that they were going to grant the extradition and there was going to be a appeal filed immediately. And we also all knew that he wasn't going to be extradited the next day, week, month, or even year. There was going to be a, you know, time where he would obviously still be in Spain. So I spoke to him in the morning, that morning of the 23rd of June, 2021. And, you know, just talking about, you know, him going to court and what should happen. And then I spoke to him again in the afternoon, late morning, early afternoon, you know, about what happened in the court. And obviously he was disappointed, but again, what happened, their decision was expected. So no surprise there. And, you know, we kind of just chit chatted and you know, the last things he said to me was, okay, you know, I love you and I'll call you later. And so that was that. And I went about my day. What I would do was collect the daily headlines from different news outlets just to talk to him about, you know, to keep him kind of up to date on what was happening in the world or just to tell him about my day or whatever, you know, to kind of just give him an escape from, you know, from whatever was going on in the prison. And I think it was around 4 o'clock-ish. So right around the time where I should have been, you know, would have been close to getting that third phone call from it. And I happened to be on Twitter at the time and I got a notification of a DM and the DM said, oh my God, tell me this isn't true. And it didn't say what that person was referring to, but I don't know why. I just immediately went to Google John's name, and then I saw that he had died, and so that's how I found out. That's how the attorney found out. I will say also, I will add this. I don't know if I've shared this before, but so the day before. As you were talking about the tweet, the day before, he had shared with me that he had a premonition. All right. And whatever it was really bad because it freaked him out. It weirded him out. but he didn't tell me what it was. He didn't share with me what that premonition was. And then he spoke to me about it again, I think the next morning as well. But again, he didn't tell me what it was. And so obviously when this happened, this is running through my mind. Like, what was the premonition? And is this the premonition that he was talking about, or you know, that he was concerned about? Like, what? I don't know. So that was a really, 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 really rough day for me. Just because finding out that way, you know, I would have appreciated the prison calling the attorney at least, you know, and letting us find out that way. It's really kind of a cruel way to have to find out that your, you know, your loved one has died, you know. And mostly I think I kind of seesawed between disbelief and just absolute devastation, you know. You know, it was just kind of a blur what happened then. And so after that, I was able to go to the prison to pick up his belongings. And I spoke with, I believe it was not the warden, but he was the head of the guards there. He was the head, you know, person of that. And so he spoke very kindly or very highly of John and said, you know, that everybody liked him. And he, you know, he didn't seem like he was in a bad mood or anything. Like, everything seemed normal with him. He was his same usual self, you know, joking with people, laughing and smiling, talking. You know, he wasn't, you know, depressed or anything or down. They just said he was normal, his normal self. And then he was, you know, very surprised about what happened. You know, something that also kind of struck me that he told me was when they found him, when he was initially found in the cell, his feet were on the floor. And it was always very puzzling to me why he would go out of his way to share that bit of information with me, because obviously, if anyone's familiar with the Epstein situation, he was found in the same way when he was hanging. His feet were on the floor. And so it just, and so now that's in my mind. Like, why is he sharing that with me? And is he trying to let me know that maybe something similar along the lines of Epstein happened with John? Obviously, I've not accepted that he was suicidal, just because I spoke to him, you know, and I knew him very well, you know, and it just didn't seem like that's where his mind was, you know. And in the absence of the autopsy report, I could only speculate, you know. And so I want to know what happened to him, which is why I've been waiting to, and why I've appealed their decision to not give me the autopsy report, because I want to know what happened. Because he actually was not dead when they found him. When he was found, he was still alive. He had a heartbeat. He had a pulse. And so I just want to know what happened from them finding him alive and then pronouncing him dead. What happened in between that time?
Why do you think you're being denied this opportunity? Why are they dragging their feet, which is an English saying, just means why are they, you know, making this almost impossible for, you know, you to find out? And of course, the biggest thing, you know, you can't have the body released until this is rectified.
Yes, right, exactly. Which, you know, it was a tough decision. I will say that it was very tough for me to say, okay, appeal it. But even looking back then, I had no idea how long it was going to take them to decide this. At the time, I didn't know that 6 to 8 months was the time frame of how long it could take them to make this decision. So from February to October of 2022 would have been the 8 month period. And I still haven't heard, they haven't rendered their decision. We're now in February of 2023. So a full year later, and I'm still waiting for their decision. Why they are reluctant to release the autopsy report, I have no idea. I don't understand it. You know, I can't I have no reason why. You know, there's nothing that makes sense to me why they would be hiding or delaying, other than maybe there's something that they're trying to hide. You know, that's obviously the only reasonable conclusion that one could come to. You know, if this was just an open and shut suicide, open and shut case of a suicide, well, then there should be no problem with me getting the autopsy report, you know, and because that's all that I want. I just want to know what happened. I don't want to accuse anyone of anything. I don't want to fight anyone. I just want to know what happened. Because again, it's been falsely reported that he was found dead in his cell. He was not dead. He had a pulse. And so I want to know what happened from the time that he was found until the time that they pronounced him. Not because I think that something was done to him, but because I just want to know. And I think that is just a reasonable thing for someone to want to know what happened to their loved one, you know? And so I'm still here in Spain waiting for that decision and hoping that maybe bringing, you know, the public's attention to what's happening, maybe that will help to pressure the courts into rendering a decision sooner rather than later, because I don't want to be sitting here on the 2-year anniversary of John's death and him still not being laid to rest.
Is there anything that anybody can do to help you, Janice?
Just spread the word, I guess. You know, honestly, I don't know. You know, unless you know the judges in Spain. And not threatening anyone. I'm just saying, you know, unless you
know you
have
mean,
their email. Maybe if you have their email or a way for me to contact them and say, hey, you know,
even
you please?
Petition. A petition. I mean, it's something simple. It's something simple. Yeah. But it can be effective if you get a mass swell of people who sign it.
So I have, there is a petition. If you go to releasemcafee.com, you can find the petition there. You can sign it and share it if you like. But honestly, the petition is, in this situation, I'm not sure if it is helping or will help to sort of move their decision-making. But definitely, it is a way to keep the public eye on it and to keep the conversation going about what's happening. So that doesn't, you know, kind of die off, because this being in the public eye obviously makes it a lot easier or maybe more difficult for people to let this sort of fall by the wayside.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing about it is exposure. Like you said, you know, the Netflix drama, I think the documentary that people will have seen, again, it raises the profile. Netflix is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, you know, streaming channel, you know, in the world now.
Yes, it is. Yeah, I don't know if you saw the documentary. It was entertaining, I will say that.
It's an entertainment. That's the thing. That's the thing. And I think that's why podcasts like this, and I know you've been on one or two other podcasts of which, you know, I'm a big fan of. And you know, that's the way, because it's not controlled to a degree. You know, we allow you to speak. We'll let you get your message across and say what potentially other channels would not allow, you know, you to say.
Yes, and I thank you so much for that, and I appreciate that. But allowing me the opportunity to kind of set the record straight as far as, you know, him not being dead when they found him, you know. And obviously, I was able to identify his remains. So I know there's some people out there that say, oh, he's alive and all of this. But no, I saw his body, you know, and I'm sure it was him. And so, just if we could just share this, you know, your viewers, if you could just share it with whomever, and it just helped to sort of spread the word and help to bring attention to this.
Nick and Katie are big fans of mine, which is very nice of them. They often reach out to people, and Nick reached out to you to ask if you'd be up for coming on the podcast. A big thanks.
Thank you, Nick.
I always give him an opportunity to ask a question. Now, he sent me two, Janice. So these are the two questions from Nick. He first of all would like to know your thoughts about gun control, the Second Amendment, for example. And he said, because he remembers John saying in a tweet that the USA should be ready for a, as he said, a civil war over gun control. Now, as a member of, you know, as a human being and somebody who lives in the UK, you know, our media constantly puts out, you know, news from the US about mass shootings, and you know, we see arguments time and time again between two sides of the fence about, you know, should guns be legalized, should they be taken away. What's your view? Nick's wanting to know.
So my personal opinion is that gun control only hinders the law-abiding citizen, to if they wanted to purchase a gun, to be able to purchase it to protect themselves. That is the fundamental reason for the Second Amendment. Actually, I'm sorry. It's not the the fundamental reason is not for you to protect yourself just from your fellow citizens, but the Second Amendment was actually created to enable the citizens to arm themselves in the event that their government became tyrannical. And so that is why the Second Amendment is so important, and why it's so fought against when the government tries to issue new gun control laws. If you notice, I know the mass shootings are terrible things that have happened are happening. But I don't think that more gun control would fix that. Also, it's my understanding that a lot of these shootings are happening in areas where there are very strict gun control, laws, where there's not open carry laws. And so I tend to feel like if, there's in Texas and in the South, the South of the United States is a very open carry, heavily armed area. And you don't see a lot of mass shootings happening there. Obviously, there's crime there, there's violence there, but I think a lot of it is deterred because all of the citizens are actually armed, and I think that it is up to the individual that they should have the right, if they want to purchase a gun, they should have that right to do so. And obviously, needing proper training, to take care of themselves. But I think also we have a mental health crisis that's happening as well, because when we find out, once these mass shootings happen and more information is understood about the person who carried out the shooting, you understand that there was probably some mental health issues there that maybe were never addressed or were not properly addressed. And I think if we start addressing that, maybe that might help. Also, there's times where people kind of knew that the person was maybe not behaving normally, or there was things that were off about them, but they didn't report it. They didn't do anything to step in, and so it's more than just a gun issue, I think, these mass shootings. And I'm very much in favor of the Second Amendment. I think every citizen should be able to protect themselves. And I think we could also note from history what happens when a nation is disarmed, and how tyranny can run free then, because the citizens are not able to protect themselves against a tyrannical government. So.
Interesting. Okay, next question. You just wanted to know, had you ever heard of Andrew Tate, who's obviously huge news at the moment? And what Nick says is some might say that he is going against the establishment, and now he's being arrested. Now he has been banged up, as he calls it, and he's being hunted. He says, in fact, I think Andrew's already said something like, "I will never kill myself as a warning," which has similarities to something that that John said, many years ago on Twitter. But yeah, Andrew Tate, have you come across him, and what's your thoughts on the Matrix?
I have come across him. I will say he's very interesting. His opinions are very interesting. Not I guess maybe I could say it's understandable why they are coming after him in this way, because his own words, when taken out of context, obviously they testify against him, and paint a very not so nice picture of him. So, but it definitely does feel like there's something more to what's happening to him. It definitely feels like there's maybe a unified sort of attack against him. It definitely seems that way. I'm not sure what he's meaning by the Matrix, what he's referring to in that way, but there definitely is powers that be that are sort of kind of in the shadows, controlling things, controlling narratives, controlling opinions by what they put on the news, by what's not put on the news, even. So there is definitely a problematic shadow system that is running behind the scenes, if you will, and most people don't see it. And so I think I do like the fact that he's brought that to light, and he's made it a message that has been something that younger generations are receiving. so that they're understanding that things are not as they seem and that you should not take what your government says at face value. You know, I know that probably may be a lot for you guys in the UK because obviously there's a different relationship with your, you know, with your government, but America, we were founded because of running from what they saw as tyranny, you know, and wanting to be free. And so that's just embedded in us as Americans. And, but for me, I have always been a person who questioned authority, sometimes to my own detriment.
Yeah.
But it's just a natural thing. You know, I hear what you're saying, but what is actually happening? Because usually there's something, and this has been proven time and time again with some of the FBI releasing unclassifying some documents, maybe about the Kennedy assassination. You know, everyone always said that the CIA was involved, and now we know that they were involved, you know, and so, so these things kind of help to prove why we should question, you know, and why we can't get rid of the Second Amendment, right? Because of these things that have been proven by these, you know, unclassifying of documents. So, so I do like Andrew, his messaging as far as that goes, as far as bringing that to light and bringing people's attention to that. His views on women are obviously very controversial,
very
extreme. I don't agree with a lot of it, but some of it is it's right. You know, you don't want the women. I think women don't understand that. Yes, you're free to be promiscuous and you're free to dress how you want to dress and all of that. But at the end of the day, you're hurting yourself. You know, you may be having fun in the time and the moment. And I'm speaking to this because of my profession, what my profession was. So I understand that you die a slow death daily, you know, living in that world. And that's exactly where I was. You know, I wasn't happy. It was just a situation that I found myself in, and that I was because of my fear of my pimp and what he would do to me if I tried to run away. You know, I allowed myself to stay in it a lot longer than I should have. But being promiscuous is something that's only going to hurt the women. You know, because you're mostly being promiscuous with men that don't deserve you anyways. They have, you know, they're not men that would appreciate you and care for you as men should. And so that then jades you to any good man that you may meet in the future, you know? So definitely, I think that's kind of the gist of what he's trying to say, but he takes a more obviously in your face kind of controversial approach to it. And I hope that he is able to get out of this situation if he is innocent. And I hope that, you know, with all of the attention that's on him, that if this is a you know, sort of a concerted effort to silence him, I hope that doesn't happen.
Yeah, you mentioned our government. There's not a lot of faith in our government from the British people either, believe
okay.
you me. Last question from Nick, and it was he said, obviously, John was somebody who was very interested in politics, and of course, as we've already mentioned, ran not once but twice for presidential election. He says, is Janice interested in politics at all? And will Janice ever live back in the US? And would you even consider running at any time?
So about the US, yes, I want to live back in the US as much as I talk about it. But I love the US. It's my home. You know, it's where I grew up. And I want to be back there. My family's there, obviously. And once this situation here is resolved, I will be returning to America. I've not thought about politics or getting into politics, but I do have a desire to get into outreach for women who were in abusive relationships, women who are still in the prostitution industry. And so that's where my heart is. That's what I want to hopefully be able to become an activist in that, if you will, you know, and just not more so speaking publicly so much to it, but speaking to those women directly. You know, I want to be able to do that. And I believe that my story could help a lot of people. And so that's what I want to do. Now, if politics happens down the line, I don't know who's to say, but it's definitely not a goal of mine. I'll say that.
You've got a platform now, you know, any young lady or young man, you know, in England who is going down that particular route through, you know, no choice of their own, let's say, but someone who has to make that decision, that you had to make so many years ago, what advice would you give them? Is it easy to give advice? I don't know. I've never been in that situation. I'm very lucky. But from your perspective, what would you say to somebody who is potentially going down that particular avenue at this moment in time?
I guess the best thing I could say is that no matter how hopeless your situation looks, there are people that care about you. And maybe you don't have that in your life right now, but I care, and there are people that do care, and there are places that you can go for help. You can reach out to me. My DMs are open, and reach out to me if you want to speak to me about these things. Obviously, I'm not actively, I'm not an activist at the moment, but I'm willing to talk to you if you want to talk and just share your story. And just know that you can find a way back to normalcy, if you will, or you can find a way out of that situation. It may be tricky, it may be scary, obviously very scary because it was for me. And but if you continue to stay in it, you'll only end up dead or addicted to drugs, or it just and there's that's just no way for anyone to live. And I just think that if you reach out for help, the help you'll find it. As scary as it is, you can find the help that you need to get out of the situation. So I think that's the best advice that I could give without speaking individually with someone and knowing their situation.
I'm going to obviously get your contact details and what you want to share, and I'll stick them in the link below. I just want to ask Janice, and I don't do this very often with guests, and maybe I should do, but your story's been so compelling, and I felt quite emotional listening to you at times. I just want to ask how you are.
Oh, thank you. I'm okay, actually. I wasn't for a long time, maybe the first year after John died. There were some situations that happened, and I thought I was gonna die. It was pretty intense, but I'm okay. I think I've cried myself silly mostly. And it's still hard to be on Twitter and people talk about John, or they'll put pictures or videos. It's hard for me to look at them just because the situation is still so raw, and so it's just still happening. I'm not able to move forward, so it is very difficult. And I don't wish this on anyone, not even my worst enemy. Just this sort of limbo. Where you don't know what's happening. I can't make any plans. I'm just here, trying to survive and, wait for an answer. But outside of that, I'm okay. I'm okay. It's been a good time for me, a healing time for me. Separate from John, that situation, I had a lot of healing I had to do for myself personally, and so I've allowed this time alone in solitude to kind of do that and address those things that have kind of been negative things in my life, that and try to heal those that brokenness. And so aside from why I'm still here, I am okay. Yes, thank you.
Janice, you've been a wonderful guest. If you ever
Thank
need, a chat, if you ever need more help on trying to get, what you need, then feel free to reach out because, I think you do deserve, all the help you can get, and let's hope you get some kind of resolve, very, very soon. All your links will be below. The very best of luck, and just keep being you, Janice.
Thank you. I will. Thank you so much.
And I'd like to dedicate this, obviously, to John David
Yes.
McAfee, the man, the myth, the legend. And yeah, wow, what a life he led. And he's left a legacy and left, a lot of good memories for you, I'm sure. Rest in peace, John. Thank you very much, Janice. Take
Thank
care.
you.
Bye bye.
Thank you.
Thanks, Janice. Are you okay?
Thank you. Yeah, I'm okay.